from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Henry James used to mock the idea of the great American novel, but he may have written it, says my guest today, Portrait of a Lady, 1881. James, the famous expatriate, giving us his young American heroine abroad, Isabel Archer. The novel is a bridge up out of the Victorian age, a bridge toward the modern and the modern woman, and a study in its way of American exceptionalism, a hot topic again today in 2012. This hour on Point, Henry James, Human Nature and American Exceptionalism. You can join the conversation. Was James on to something about how exceptional Americans really are? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Michael Gora. He's a professor of English language and literature at Smith College and author of the big new book, Portrait of a Novel, Henry James and the Making of an American Masterpiece. Michael Gora, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much for lifting this book up and bringing it back to our attention. And it comes at a really particularly interesting time. You've got some biography in here, but also, in a way, the biography of a novel sort of woven together that you're bringing us. Describe your project here, Michael.
Well, I wanted to tell the story of this novel. And by that, I mean I wanted to tell the story in the novel, following its characters out year by year, almost chapter by chapter in their imaginary lives. But I also wanted to tell the story of the novel, that is, how James came to write it and what from his own life and background and experience went into the making of it, and then how it was published and read and received. And then many years later, he revised it and made changes in almost every paragraph, and in doing so gave his heroine a new sort of almost pungent physical life that she hadn't had before.
There's so much.
So I wanted to combine those things, and I ping-pong back and forth between the work and the life.
It's terrific, and there's so much we want to look at here. The thing that's kind of in the news lately with the political season upon us, the political party conventions, we've just been down in Charlotte and Tampa hearing a lot of American exceptionalism talk, particularly in Tampa, but you can hear it in Charlotte as well. And you've written that, this is in some way, at least in the understanding of his time, and we're going back a century and more here, Henry James pushing back against part of that. He has his heroine here, Isabel Archer, who's in Europe. We'll look at that story. But you remind us she had once thought herself for that she had once thought that, quoting here, the world is all before us and the world is very large, very American idea, that unbounded promise. You've written that she learns that America itself has had no separate or special creation, that there is no fresh start, no city on a hill, no exemption from history itself. Your interpretation going straight into the teeth of a lot of rhetoric we heard at the convention.
It is. I think it is. And that's not what I started out to write, I think. But it's what I found. What is there immediately for James that he's pushing back against is in a way his family friend, Ralph Waldo Emerson, with the idea that of self-reliance, that we can be self-reliant, that we can make our own destinies. And of course, James's heroine believes that she can, as you quoted from the novel. She thinks that the world is all before her, that she can go wherever she wants, do whatever she wants. She has money and intelligence. There seems to be no material restraint on her, and yet what she finds over the course of the novel is that she's not free as in the way that she thinks. She has never been free. Other people have always acted upon her. Other people's choices and desires have constrained her. She's thought of herself as isolated, but she's had to learn, much to her pain and to her cost, that she lives in a world of other people who inhibit what she wants to do. And I think James sees that as in a way, the American faith, that we think we're alone. We think we've made our own lives, our own land, our own destiny. But we do live in a world with others. And part of what that novel is about is Isabel's discovery of just what that means.
You're prepared
to live in a world with others.
You're prepared to take her experience up to the national level, and maybe he was as well. I want to share some of the story, though a lot of it is very interior in a modern way.
It is, yes.
Some of it really groundbreakingly so, but just to give listeners a sense of Portrait of a Lady, for those who haven't read it or not recently anyway, here's a little bit. This is from chapter 2 in the book, and this was written in 1881, polished up, burnished a lot later in 1906, I guess, and you write about that. But here's a little bit where it describes Isabel Archer, young American. She's plenty of money, or will have, it turns out, arriving for tea here at an English country estate. It's read here by Marvin Kane in the 2009 unabridged audiobook of Portrait of a Lady.
She'd been looking all round her again, at the lawn, the grey trees, the reedy, silvery Thames, the beautiful old house. And while engaged in this survey, she had made room in it for her companions, a comprehensiveness of observation easily conceivable on the part of a young woman who was evidently both intelligent and excited. She had seated herself and had put away the little dog, her white hands, in her lap, were folded upon her black dress. Her head was erect, her eye lighted, her flexible figure turned itself easily this way and that, in sympathy with the alertness with which she evidently caught impressions. Her impressions were numerous, and they were all reflected in a clear, still smile. I've never seen anything so beautiful as this.
Marvin Kane, reading there from Portrait of a Lady. And right away, we realize this may be the great American novel. This is no Huckleberry Finn. This is not Life on the Mississippi. This is the rivers of Europe. And this is
it's
a refined Henry James sensibility.
It's the Thames Valley in London, and later it's going to be Florence and Rome.
Yes, the Arno. Yeah. And this incredibly, as he puts it there, intelligent and excited, the flexible figure of this very alert young woman. Alert to what? What's her story, Michael?
Well, Isabel is a young woman. She's an orphan. Her parents have died, and she's been taken up by an aunt, a rich aunt, and brought to England mostly, it seems, to amuse the aunt. Mm-hmm. And when she's there, she's going to find that her uncle by marriage, who's an American banker in London, is very taken with her and wants to do something for her. She has a cousin, Ralph, who suffers from tuberculosis and who would be in love with her if, one, he weren't ill, and two, if he thought it was a good idea to marry her cousin. Mm. She's eventually going to get a fortune from that uncle, and she's going to then make her way through Europe. And along the way, she's going to turn down a number of proposals because she's not yet ready to confine herself in marriage. She says that she always wants to know the things that you should do. And her aunt says, so you can refuse to do them? And she says, no, so that I can choose. Mm-hmm. So she can choose the terms on which she's going to engage the world. But my own sense is that this European setting of James's is a way, what it does is to magnify her sense of isolation and freedom, that we think of ourselves as living alone. And when she's there moving richly against this background of Europe, it augments her American sense of being in control of her own life.
To make her way here, young, alert, unbounded by any material problems. She's rich.
She is, yes.
But it turns out that making her own way, that choosing the terms on which she's going to engage the world, not so simple, even with all that youth and alertness and wealth.
Exactly. And partly it's not so easy because she overestimates the degree of her own freedom. She thinks she's free. You quoted those lines from the novel earlier. She could go wherever she wanted. Those are an echo of, deliberately on James's part, of the very end of Paradise Lost, when Adam and Eve are expelled from Eden and they have to make their way through a fallen world. Isabel doesn't yet know her world is fallen. And I think that's part of her Americanness too. She doesn't know the world is fallen. She doesn't believe that there are constraints placed upon her. She's naive, and what she finds is she comes up against a world of people who are not naive in that way, who want things from her and not necessarily for her own good.
Was James, you're looking here at the book and the man, was he deliberately presenting Isabel Archer here as a stand-in for her native country, for America?
I think so. I think so. Not in any simplistic or schematic symbolic way, but James found his material in the meeting of the old world and the new, and his own distinctive material in putting America with its idealism and its sense of freedom. And you know, James also, he believed, part of him wanted to believe in that idea of self-reliance, that you can make your own way. And he thought one of the best things about being an American was we could pick and choose the different parts of cultures from other lands that suited us best. We could make it as we went along. He liked that, but he was in a way suspicious of it. So he finds this material in bumping America and Europe up against each other. And sometimes he would send European characters to America in his fiction, but most often he put his Americans down in Europe and then watched what would happen to them. And being there, I think, heightens their sense of their own Americanness in a way that you don't necessarily have that sense when you're at home.
It's a really a marvelous angle for looking at this, and you tell the story so well. This is a long way from a raft on the Mississippi.
It is a long way. I mean, James knows when you light out for the territory, there are going to be people there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about, well, many things, but American exceptionalism from another angle: freedom, human nature, gender, and the great Henry James novel, Portrait of a Lady. Michael Gora is with us. He's written a new book, Portrait of a Novel, Henry James and the Making of an American Masterpiece. He's author of After Empire and The Bells in Their Silence. Joins us today from Amherst, Massachusetts. What can we learn from this master of a century and more ago about American exceptionalism, maybe our understanding of it today? It's been in the news. Here was a former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice addressing the Republican National Convention on August 29th in Tampa. She spoke specifically about American exceptionalism.
When the world looks to America, they look to us because we are the most successful economic and political experiment in human history. That is the true basis of American exceptionalism. You see, the essence of America, what really unites us, is not nationality or ethnicity or religion. It is an idea. And what an idea it is, that you can come from humble circumstances and you can do great things, that it does not matter where you came from, it matters where you are going.
Condoleezza Rice at the Republican convention just 10 days ago. Michael Gora, what are you thinking as you listen to that, with all of Henry James at your back and Portrait of a Lady and Isabel Archer?
Well, one of the things I'm thinking about is a line from one of our founding fathers, John Adams, which I quote in the book, which he says, in effect, that there is no special creation for Americans, and we are bound by the same laws as other lands. We may have been especially successful at bending the world to our will and our political system and some of our economic successes has indeed been a model for other people. But that doesn't mean that we stand alone, that we can do things without regard for others, that the same guiding principles, the same laws that we're not immune from history. We're not, you know, the city on a hill, the idea that some of our pilgrim fathers had, which President Reagan quoted. Well, it's an idea. It's not a fact.
Well, I mean, and part of me, you know, just reading all this and reading you, I will understand what you're saying there. Part of me, on the other hand, says, where do you get off saying that? I mean, Americans have made history. I know European friends, some look at Americans as naive, but others look at Americans with a kind of envy of that, the attitude that we can make history, we can do things differently. You know, the old American idea, Michael, that attitude itself makes things possible. You know, I mean, in the Bush administration, this became almost a religion. You know, what was the phrase? We put ideas out there and they become reality. They are reality.
That
can be empowering, can it not? Or is it all?
Sure. It can be empowering. And these are our guiding myths. These are our guiding myths, and by that I don't mean that they're false, but they're some of the principles, the ways we organize our lives and our minds. At the same time, however, we have to be aware that we don't have an absolute freedom to shape the world to suit our purposes. That certainly is the lesson that James shows us with Isabel and with many of his other heroines. Let me tell you a story about James late in his life. Mm-hmm. He'd been living in England for many years, and he's an old man. And World War I comes. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happens to James in World War I is he begins to – he's been living in England for years, but he's never become a British citizen. He finds, though, as he's living in Britain, that he is increasingly upset and disturbed by American isolationism, by the fact that we're holding – you know, he sees that there's a kind of almost a union of culture and language between Britain and America, and he's increasingly upset by America's desire to stay out of mm-hmm. that war. To stay alone. And finally what he does, and it's really the last important thing he does in his life, is he goes and becomes a British citizen.
Well, a citizen or subject? I don't know what it is.
Well, it was legally a subject, yes. Mm-hmm. He is sponsored for the citizenship for all the papers by the English Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. He takes it out. He is roundly attacked in the American press for this, for having sided with England,
no doubt,
having renounced mm-hmm. his Americanism. Of course, a year later, we're in that war. Mm-hmm. We found we can't stand alone. He's just a little bit ahead of the game in that.
Let's take a call here, and I want to bring Susan Griffin in just a moment. But Elizabeth in Montreal, Canada, is calling in. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air. What do you think?
Yes. I hope I'm on the right track when I say this, if I remember correctly from the course that I took. we discussed James as talking about American exceptionalism as compared to what? As compared to Europe. And why Americans like to go to Europe. And the reason why they like to go to Europe was because of it's an old civilization. It's slightly decadent. It's an aged civilization. And it possibly had something to offer. But as compared to Americans and their myth-making, America was viewed as young, vibrant, mm-hmm. with the possibility of many choices, as your speaker has said. Mm-hmm. But in the end, you know, your protagonist, your female protagonist, ends up realizing that she doesn't have the choices that she really thought she did. And the reason for that is maybe in a sense we were no different from the European civilization that Americans were always in that century heading towards.
Elizabeth, may I ask you, are you thinking about this as an American, as a Canadian, either?
I'm thinking of this as having read a lot of literature and having done a lot of seminars on American literature as well. And this is what we used to talk about a lot. Mm-hmm. The fact that what the European culture portrayed vis-a-vis for Americans and how Americans viewed it and how they saw themselves as compared to it.
Yeah.
And their youthfulness and their vibrancy and their idealism, was lauded, it was applauded, but to what extent? Because in the end, like I said, your female protagonist ends up being in a no better situation than any woman, perhaps in Europe, in the European civilization then, women had more choices to make because of they had gone through, the historical ups and downs and wars and whatever.
Right, and here she is unhappily married, unhappy in any number of ways, and ultimately not feeling so free to choose, feeling constrained. Elizabeth, in Montreal, I appreciate that call. I want to bring in, if I may, Michael, Susan Griffin right now.
Of course.
She's chair of the English department at the University of Louisville, editor of the Henry James Review, editor of The Men Who Knew Too Much, Henry James Goes to the Movies, and The Art of Criticism. Susan Griffin joins us from Louisville, Kentucky. Susan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for asking me.
So,
morning, Michael.
Here's Michael. Michael, Susan, I think you've read this book. You know Michael goes at many angles here, and we'll touch on some, this path out of the Victorian age in a way into the modern, the role of women. But this note of American exceptionalism with the political season on us is particularly resonant for us right now. How do you look at Henry James and the way he saw his home country back across the Atlantic, maybe even through the character, the eyes of Isabel Archer, through her experience, Susan?
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with much of what Michael has to say. I do think, though, that there is a difference insofar as Isabel is incredibly attractive to everyone mm-hmm. around her.
Yep.
And that for James, the kind of openness, the fresh eye, the set of possibilities that some Americans bring is not just refreshing, but important, and that it's not totally extinguished by being ground in the middle of the conventional, is the way Isabel has talked about. That she starts off in a different place, and in comparison, say, with Lord Warburton, is one of her first suitors.
The rich uncle, rich
right,
guy, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right, very wealthy, and she turns him down. Well, we see his sisters at that beginning there, and they are totally conventional. They always will be, and always have been. There's the attractiveness of the American girl is because she believes in these possibilities, and there's something significant. She has to be disabused of the idea that she is totally free, but there's something significant in that belief.
No, I'd agree with that. There is a sense that she brings a spirit and an energy that she would not have without that belief. But it will only go so far mm-hmm. In letting her make that new life for herself.
I mean, you say, Susan, that she's ultimately sort of hemmed in by the very conventions she's been trying to avoid. Can we make that a parallel to the nation itself? Was Henry James thinking that broadly in the person of Isabel Archer about his home country, Susan?
Well, he believes that everyone is, it's not just Americans, mm-hmm. that
yeah,
everyone
right.
is hemmed in, that you don't exist as an individual apart from society, right? Which isn't to say that you don't have any freedom. And Isabel chooses at the end of the novel to go back to Rome, to go back to Osmond. She doesn't need to do that. She chooses to reject her American suitor, Caspar Goodwood, again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could say what she chooses is convention, but it's not clear. He deliberately ends the novel up in the air. We know that she's headed to Rome. We don't know what exactly is going to happen. But she's honoring the choice that she made earlier, which is the choice that she married. She says, you know, I was totally free when I married Osmond. Nobody made me do it. So she goes back. Does she go back to save her stepdaughter, Pansy? Does she go back to completely give in to her husband? Doubtful.
We don't know. And James
know.
Infuriated
we
readers
know.
At that yeah. time with that kind of modern, up-in-the-air ending. Let's hear a little bit more. This is from Michael Gore and many others, in a way, most lauded chapter of the book, chapter 42, where we get into a kind of stream of consciousness that presages modernism here. Is a reading from, again, the audiobook of 09. Isabel Archer sitting in front of a fireplace. It's all interiority here, thinking, regretting, or decision to marry Gilbert Osmond.
She had made herself small, pretending there was less of her than there really was. It was because she had been under the extraordinary charm that he, on his side, had taken pains to put forth. He was not changed. He had not disguised himself during the year of his courtship any more than she. But she had seen only half his nature then, as one saw the disk of the moon when it was partly masked by the shadow of the earth. She saw the full moon now. She saw the whole man. She had kept still, as it were, so that he should have a free field. And yet, in spite of this, she had mistaken a part for the whole.
Isabel Archer's interior stream of thought there. Michael Gora, in her contemplation, does James have her come to the explicit kind of understanding that you're describing here about choice and its freedom and their limits?
Not at that moment. She needs to learn some other things before the end of the novel. This is the start of the process, this chapter, by which she learns and is able to articulate the ways in which she's been caught by the desires of other people. She needs to learn a few crucial facts before she can really put that all together. And I'm not going to tell you what those facts are now. I don't want to spoil the book for those who haven't read it. But what does happen here is Isabel sits in front of this fireplace for 15 pages. She doesn't move except her mind moves. Her mind goes everywhere, and she begins to piece together the way her life has gone, to see her husband and more clearly than she ever has before, and to see the nature of the choice that she's made more clearly than she has, to realize what it was she wanted, what it was that attracted her to him. Disastrous choice. And then how their marriage has gone day by day in ways that have increasingly hemmed her in.
You know, take it to the nation, you wonder if making disastrous choices is the same as concluding that there is not an exceptionalism. Lauren in Newton, Massachusetts. Lauren, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a recent graduate, and 2 years ago I went to study abroad at Oxford University for a year. And I was so shocked because hearing about Portrait of a Lady just brought back so many feelings that I had while I was over there. So I certainly feel that a lot of what he wrote about is still alive for today. And I don't want to speak for everyone, but I went across the pond very sort of naive. I was educated at a small liberal arts school, and I was used to my professors sort of caring what I thought, and I certainly wasn't prepared for a lot of the class sensitivity that they have, and sort of where people went to private school was very, very important. And this is sort of going into a new system where hierarchy is very important. Sort of, I was certainly surprised as an American, and I don't mean to sort of degrade their society or anything, or to speak for everyone, but certainly it was true still in my experience.
So, Lauren, so you're our Isabel Archer in a way. Did you end up feeling exceptional as American, or just different?
I didn't feel exceptional per se. I don't want to bring it up that high, but I definitely felt lucky. I mean, for example, I went to the dean of my college because I was trying to do research for either a professor or a graduate student, and she actually laughed in my face and said, well, why would a professor or a graduate student want to work with an undergraduate? I just think that sense of this is your place in the school, this is your place in our society, it can still be very present, especially in an old school like Oxford.
Lauren, I so appreciate your call. I mean, Michael Gora, there it is. The overall notion of exceptionalism may have its flaws, but there are certainly different expectations. Isabel had them sort of our Lauren here.
It's true, and I've heard over and over again from my own students or from readers that young American women going to Europe now, Isabel speaks to them. They are ingenues in the same way that she is, and what they find out about that old world is not always very comfortable.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about American exceptionalism from another angle, freedom, human nature, gender, and the great Henry James novel, Portrait of a Lady. Michael Gora is with us from Smith College. He's just written Portrait of a Novel, Henry James and the Making of an American Masterpiece. It's all about Portrait of a Lady, the many strands of James' life as he wrote and revised that great work. And its reflection on this country, kind of bridge out of the Victorian age, he says, a bridge into the modern, kind of proto-feminist, and its protagonist, Isabel Archer. He joins us today from Amherst, Massachusetts. And Susan Griffin is here as well, editor of the Henry James Review, chair of the English department at the University of Louisville, author of The Men Who Knew Too Much, Henry James Goes to the Movies, and more. Here's just a bit from the 1996 film adaptation. Here's Goodwood wooing Isabel Archer, played by Viggo Mortensen, here, tries to convince Isabel, played by Nicole Kidman, to stay in England and not return to her husband in Rome. It's an offer that she refuses.
You're perfectly alone. Now I want you to think of me.
To think of you.
Turn to me. Why should you go back? Why should you go through that ghastly form?
To get away from
you. I want
you
to prevent that. Can only for once listen to me. Why shouldn't we be happy? Why? Why, when it's here before us, when it's so easy? We can do absolutely as we please. To whom under the sun do we owe anything?
Viggo Mortensen and Nicole Kidman there in the 1996 film version of Portrait of a Lady. Michael Gorder, that's a moment where she kind of peers, talk about, she peers into a great, great human commonality and steps back, as you write.
She does. You know, as I was listening to that, it struck me, he says, you're perfectly alone. And then he says, turn to me, which of course cuts against that aloneness. You know, that what she steps back from there, is passion, is sex, is physical desire. And I think she steps back from it at that moment because, as James shows in the novel, because that's the moment at which she most keenly feels it. What she's learned over the course of the novel, she learns in sitting in front of that fireplace, as we talked about, that though other people have made decisions, have done things that have shaped her life, that her life has been shaped by things that happened before she was even thought of, by the history of others.
Mm-hmm.
She's learned that what she does have is a free mind. She knows, and her mind has gotten progressively more free insofar as she knows what other people have done. And what she fears most, I think, in that moment with Goodwood,
mm-hmm.
is to lose her freedom of mind under the force of passion.
To carnality, to sexuality. You call it the most frankly sexual moment in all of James' fiction. We just hear Nicole Kidman's sort of rapid breath there. But I don't know if you have your book with you, Michael. Could you read that little bit? On 328, you've got the flash spread. I mean, this is a very sexual moment, and she feels it. She feels it fully, and then she steps away. And it's interesting, if you could read that from... This is really what the moment that's at the heart of the movie clip we just heard, but not read in the movie.
Okay, Goodwood's kiss in an early version of the novel was a flash of lightning, but in the later version from 1906, it's a flash that spread and spread again and stayed. And it was extraordinarily as if, while she took it, she felt each thing in his hard manhood that had least pleased her, each aggressive fact of his face, his figure, his presence, justified of its intense identity and made one with this act of possession. So had she heard of those wrecked and underwater following a train of images before they sink. But when darkness returned, she was free.
She feels all that, but in the end she doesn't go there. There's a kind of drowning suggested there that she refuses. But Susan, is that real freedom? I mean, is it just a 19th century freedom? You know, the 20th century liberated woman wants to embrace even that full sexuality and.
Well, it's certainly not full. Well, and as the feminist movement has learned, you know, sexual freedom has obtains differently for women than it does for men.
Yeah,
but. In fact, all the way through the novel, this imagery of drowning in water and bath has been the imagery of death of the self. And precisely what would happen here would be that she would lose. I mean, marriage to Goodwood is not freedom, right? And with or without passion. I mean, the passion is one thing, but Goodwood is this incredibly rigid, hard, powerful man, mm-hmm. it is marriage, it would be something like marriage. So it's not her freedom. And the other thing is when he says, you have no one to answer to, we have no one else to consider, she does have people to answer to. She has to answer to her stepdaughter, who she has promised she would return. And she also has to answer to herself. She can't say to herself, well, someone forced me to do these things before, and so I don't have to honor those vows. That's not Isabel Archer. She did it freely, and to go back on the vows is a loss of the ideal self that she still wants to hang on to. Mm. And one of the things that doesn't get said in the movie is part of the way Goodwood tries to persuade her, he says, I swear, as I stand here, that a woman deliberately made to suffer is justified in anything in life, in going down into the streets, if that will help her. So that's what he thinks it's going to be. I mean, it's the equivalent of being a prostitute.
Run away with me. And,
right, here we go. Woohoo, yeah. Great. Yeah. I mean, what about it, Michael? Even, I don't know if we can draw, even at this most frankly sexual moment in all James fictions, as you say, can we draw up to the national level here? Is there some American denial of that the most basic human desires here that's been part of that city on a hill idea? She turns away from that. Our country has had a very touchy relationship with that side of life, more touchy than Europe's.
She turns away from it. And James does say at one point in the novel, he says that she was not a daughter of the Puritans. I think here this is where I'm would probably pull back from a national national interpretation. Mm-hmm. I think it's a more widespread thing in her century. It's not a uniquely American thing. That many heroines, many English women feel the same thing. That same hesitance on the brink of sexual experience, especially a sexual experience that's not sanctioned by mm-hmm. by marriage. She pulls back here now, and what's really interesting, this angle, is that James, in later books, though the language doesn't get more frankly sexual, mm-hmm. His heroines, especially in his last great novel, The Golden Bowl, where you have an American married to an Italian, she does allow herself to feel and to be moved by and to take as her motive force the power of her desire for her husband, which she has to learn to accept over the course of that novel.
Mm-hmm. You write here that Susan, sorry, please.
No, I was just going to say, I have to say that I don't read this scene as a fierce sexuality. And in fact, her relationship, at least initially, with Osmond is quite erotic. Mm-hmm. It's a fear of a loss of self.
A loss of the freedom of mind, yeah.
Yeah.
Michael Gore writes, she had, going back to that earlier passage, she had sat before the fire and puzzled out her life. She came to a clear understanding of the forces that had shaped and trapped her, and she learned the nature of her own blindness. She set herself free. Now she might lose it all, and that she does not want to do. But that knowing, that knowledge of the forces that had shaped and trapped her, maybe there's part of the disillusionment of exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. Lisa Ann in New Orleans. Hi, Lisa Ann. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's great listening to your show today. And I spent 4 years in my mid-20s going back between New York City and France, making money in New York so I could go back over and spend time. And I kind of ended up having this saying about Europe at the end that was the thing about Europe is that it's very deep and a little bit boring and predictable. And the thing about the United States is it can be very shallow, but it's always changing. And I had to pick at the end of that 4 years. I couldn't keep splitting my life. It felt too much to keep going back and forth. And I did choose the United States to settle down. And I am in New Orleans now, which in some ways is probably the most European city and French city you can get to in the United States.
So what did that mean to you? What did it mean you were choosing, Lisa? And was it you were choosing a great bowl of gumbo, or you were choosing freedom over history, or what was the nature of that choice to your mind?
Well, the choice was that with my female counterparts in France that I was making music with, and mm-hmm. who were very, very liberal, and the most liberal women you possibly could meet in Europe, making progressive electronic music and living life on their own terms, I still, when I was learning the French language, I started to notice that when in French, there's fewer ways to say the say things, that people use the same sayings mm-hmm. over and over again. Mm-hmm. And in English, we have a million ways to say different the same thing. Mm-hmm. And that was the first indication that in the mind, we have so much more flexibility of how we do things. And that when they were raised in tradition, even though they were liberal women, they were still raised in Europe. And I started to see the limitations of what they thought they could or couldn't do because the container that they were in was a deeper wall. Like when you hit up the edges of the walls of mm-hmm. Europe and tradition, the walls were thick and you were never getting through them. And when you come up against the wall here in America, they're kind of thin and you can punch them down and break through them pretty easily. Everything from making money as a woman, starting businesses, creating art, raising your children. You just had less tradition and history to push up against when bringing new ideas. And I felt like the Dalai Lama said it best when he's, he, quote,
that great American.
Women of the world, women of the West will change the world. And I really think he was speaking about American women.
Lisa, and that is a terrific report from New Orleans. I appreciate so much. Michael, though, there's a little echo of Condoleezza Rice there from a completely different angle. I mean, that's almost a testimony to American exceptionalism.
It is a different angle, and sure that what I think Lisa is speaking to is our capacity for self reinvention.
Maybe Henry James was missing that. I mean, you remind us that when he came back to visit the U.S. and mm-hmm. Newport and Boston and all his old haunts, he was kind of appalled. She speaks of language. He was appalled by how American English had gone off in all kinds of wild, slangy directions.
He
just misses our exceptionalism here.
Well, I think what James did was he reinvented himself by moving to Europe as a young man. Mm-hmm. He reinvented himself then. He broke away from his family. Like most Americans, he doesn't want to accept the hand he's been dealt. He broke away from his family. He made life on his own terms in Europe. Even as in doing so, he wrote about people who found that they were not as free as they'd thought. It's true, when he came back to America, he's in his 60s, and he had not been here for over 20 years. Mm. He was continually taken aback by the changes in the country. Everything was bigger. Everything was newer. He was uncertain what to make of the huge immigrant population in New York. He really wasn't certain he liked it. It was that is, the country had changed, and it was no longer the America he'd grown up in.
Was he exercising some sibling rivalry in pushing back against American exceptionalism? I mean, after all, his famous brother, William James, philosopher, godchild of Ralph Waldo Emerson? Maybe godchild
absolutely.
Of self-reliance?
Yeah,
was
absolutely. William is older by, I think, 13 months.
Yeah.
And William never lets his younger brother forget it.
13 months, so what?
No, I know. No, he never lets Henry forget that he's the older one. He's always criticizing him. He's telling him where his stories don't work. He's saying your prose is impossible and I can't read it. He's telling him he can't afford the house he wants to buy. Mm-hmm. He's a forceful older brother. And meanwhile, when Henry in their 30s and 40s, Henry is the successful one. He's the one who has readers, who has a public, who's famous, and William is toiling away as an assistant professor without any books. but he's still the older brother, and yes, there is a sense that to become himself, Henry's going to have to get away.
Susan, how do you sit back and think about all this? Americans are being asked in a difficult time now to re-embrace their exceptionalism. Maybe we're asked at every presidential election time. It's part of the way people set themselves apart at the podium to declaim on our exceptionalism. But what about the lesson of James when it comes to this country and thinking about how free it might be from the strains of history?
Well, one of the reasons James does this, people talk about it as the international theme, Americans going to Europe, Europeans mm-hmm. coming to America, is because it is much easier to see the customs, conventions, rules of in another culture. Mm-hmm. We think in America that they're, anybody can be what they want to be, and that's a wonderful ideal. But the fact of the matter is, depending on where you're born, how much money your parents have, you know, what kind of education you have.
And in fact, Condoleezza Rice came back and conceded that in the same speech we quoted earlier before it was over, these days anyway.
You know? So maybe there's, I mean, not maybe, there is more flexibility in the U.S. than many other societies. There's no question about that, and that is a wonderful thing. But what Goodwood, for example, doesn't realize is what Isabel has learned, which is freedom is not complete. You're surrounded by other people. The choice, when my son was in sixth grade, the teachers had this mantra they went over and over, and they said, the choices you make determine the choices you have, which you really want to say. You really want to say that to kids in middle school because they, you know, they're so spaced out. But that is part of what James is saying, is that the choices you make determine the choices you have. You can't suddenly, as a formed human being, decide you're going to go back and go to the beginning, you know.
And 200 years and counting, as a nation, we've made a few choices. I guess at this point, you have her at one point saying, you know, an unfallen world does indeed lie all before her, or not, Michael Gora?
She believes that there is no unfallen world before her. She believes that there is. But we now have a history.
We can
and
read
that history. That history imposes certain constraints.
We may not want them, but there they are. Henry James brings them to us. Michael Gora brings them to us in Portrait of a Novel. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us. And Susan Griffin, editor of the Henry James Review. Our time is short, but my thanks to both of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.